From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
On this week's show, a local convention focuses on separation of church and state.
There's just an increasing blurring of the lines, it seems to me, that certainly has an impact on the political scene and government in general.
Plus, as suicide rates increase, particularly among men in Kansas, we hear about area resources and support.
And what we hear from those same individuals after their treatment is, wow, I had no idea this was available. I feel so much better. Thank you for giving me my life back.
A look at the life of America's seventh president in the format of a rock musical.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. As the campaign season kicks into high gear, KCUR brings you Ad Watch, a series examining the accuracy of political ads. This week, the Missouri governor's race includes calls for stations to stop running one ad or face a lawsuit. KCUR's Brian Allison checks it out.
Candidates complaining about the content of their opponents' ads isn't so uncommon in the heat of a campaign, but cease and desist letters to the TV stations airing them? That's what Republican Dave Spence's campaign sent out last week, but the ads are still running, and new ones too, with Democratic Governor Jay Nixon doubling down with spots like this one, which came out on Tuesday.
Are you angry about Washington's bailout of Wall Street and the banks? Candidate for Governor Dave Spence helped run a bank that got a $40 million bailout.
Our bank, after I was in, took TARP funds.
On the screen, that clip of the Republican nominee is labeled St. Louis Banker Dave Spence, which led to this in a new ad from the Spence campaign, with the candidate speaking directly to the camera and words at the bottom of the screen, Dave Spence, not a banker.
I've spent the last 26 years creating jobs. And Jay Nixon, he spent those years running for office. Maybe that's why he's hiding behind false attack ads.
So what have these two men been doing for a living? Dave Spence is not primarily a banker. His day job has been running Alpha Packaging. That's a St. Louis company that makes plastic bottles and jars. He bought the company at age 25 and did run it for 26 years. But whether he's a banker depends what you mean. Spence joined the board of Eastern Missouri's Reliance Bank in 2005, joined the board of its holding company in May 2009, 3 months after that company received $40 million in federal funds. But more on that in a second. As for Jay Nixon, it's true. He has held office for 26 years, state senator, attorney general, now 4 years as governor. It's those last 4 years that both candidates want to talk about. Here's the Nixon ad on what came next with the bank.
But Dave Spence refused to pay back the taxpayers. Instead, he took an insider loan to buy a $1 million vacation home. Newspapers criticize Spence for rigging the system and trying to fool voters about his role in the bailout.
So it's true that the TARP funds weren't repaid. Spence confirmed to the Associated Press that he voted against paying back the government, deciding the bank just couldn't afford it. He resigned from the bank board in early 2011, and according to the Treasury Department website, those TARP funds still haven't been paid back. It's also true that the bank loaned Spence $1 million. Actually, more than this, on several other occasions, too, and other board members as well. That's not so uncommon, though. Sometimes bank boards are made up of the bank's best customers. It's good for business. For his part, Spence would rather talk in his ads about Nixon's record.
Nixon's attacks won't bring back the jobs we've lost because of his failed policies. With career politician Jay Nixon in charge, Missouri's doing worse than our neighbors, and we're losing more jobs.
The screen is filled with a bar graph showing the change in the size of Missouri's labor force, 90,000 fewer jobs than in January of 2009, and how that compares to other states in the region. It is the worst of the 9 states listed there, although Nixon's campaign points out that the state's unemployment rate is still below the national average. As for the claim that the state's economy is doing worse than much of the country, that's been a trend for a long time that goes beyond policy to larger issues. As one economist told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Jay Nixon's not really responsible for it, and Dave Spence probably can't fix it. In any case, one thing's for sure. The two candidates haven't finished trying to define each other, whether it be Nixon on Spence.
Dave Spence using our money to help himself.
Or Spence on Nixon.
The choice is clear. You can vote to save his job, or to save yours.
Brian Ellison, KCUR News.
For ongoing election coverage from KCUR, go to kcur.org and type in Election 2012. In Kansas and Missouri, it's now common for a lot of politicians to not just proclaim their faith, but to openly push a pro-religious agenda. But for the past year, a Kansas City-based group has been trying to push back, although in a friendly way. The Kansas City Atheist Coalition tries to shake off the stereotypes of a bitter, angry atheism while they talk to the public about the value of a secular society and government. While they avoid confrontation and even do charity work, the coalition still finds it's hard to be a non-believer on the edge of the Bible Belt. Alex Smith has this story.
On a recent Saturday night at the Overland Park Sheraton, the Baltimore Ravens checked in while their fans crowded the lobby. A huge bat mitzvah filled one of the big ballrooms, and the Kansas City Atheist Coalition was in the middle of its weekend-long regional convention. It was held exactly 1 month before the November elections, and as Coalition Board Member Veronica Brown explains, that's no accident.
We've got the election coming up in about a month, so, and there are a lot of issues that are kind of bringing us together, especially a lot of feminist issues and just, you know, the kind of the intrusion of God into the government. It's just kind of like, no, we want to all get along. Remember, we're citizens too. We're very important, you know, and just kind of trying to exercise our voice a little bit.
The convention, which was called Atheist and Patriot, hosted speakers from around the country. Their topics included things like reproductive rights, sex and politics, and school vouchers supporting religious education. There were also workshops to teach lobbying and fundraising techniques. Most of the convention addressed a trend that many attendees say has increased considerably in the past decade or so, religious fundamentalism in government.
At least back to 2004, it's been concerning me, and probably to 2000. There's just an increasing blurring of the lines, it seems to me, that certainly has an impact on the political scene and government in general.
Only one national-level politician, Representative Pete Stark of California, is openly atheist. But there's a long list of politicians who atheists say are blurring the line between church and state. When atheists are asked about the most troublesome of these, one name comes up again and again.
Well, you know, everybody loves to go back to Todd Akin, but he seems to be like a lightning rod for an anti-fundamentalist sentiment, because he expresses a lot of opinions that are about what a lot of us would refer to as dominionist policy. They say that their particular brand of Christianity is the one that should be running the government because they think they know what's best for everybody. I think that that's particularly dangerous. So when Akin says something like, you know, his particular views about rape or, you know, what brand of Christianity should be making decisions from the White House or in foreign policy and things like that, then I'm like, that's really dangerous, because I don't think that any one particular brand of religion has a monopoly on truth.
The Atheist and Patriot Convention is a regional one. Almost all of the 250 or so attendees came from either Kansas or Missouri. But the recent politics of these states gave the convention plenty of fuel for discussion. Conventioner Willard Bollinger says he's worried about states not teaching science. He mentions the recently passed Missouri Right to Pray Amendment 2, which allows students to opt out of school assignments that conflict with their faith.
I mean, I don't know what's going to happen on a test, and I can imagine corporations looking askance, kind of like when Kansas a number of years ago interfered in the science classes because they wanted creation taught in the science classes. They might look askance at whether they want to move here. I wonder about the kids, whether they're going to be able to qualify to get in colleges. I mean, this sounds like it could. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen on this.
While the majority of the criticism at the convention was targeted toward conservative politicians and politics, Steve Olson says that politicians on both sides are ignoring separation of church and state.
We've actually seen with both Romney and Obama, they have neglected the separation of church and state with Obama's expansion of the faith-based initiatives that George Bush started.
Of course, in any place but an atheist convention, these people are in a small minority. While the number is gradually increasing, just about 5% of the U.S. population claims to be atheist. The organizers and participants of this convention say it gives them a chance to meet and express secular ideas that are usually vilified.
I think what happens is you tend to sort of stifle yourself in society at large, because traditionally there's been a practice of, you know, the dominating religion, Christianity. People feel pretty much free to say whatever they want, and they just sort of assume that everyone thinks the way they do. So I think there's a real disbelief and sort of abhorrence by people I've met if they realize that you have atheistic views.
A few days before the convention, the Kansas City Atheist Coalition's president, Sarah Hargreaves, came by KCUR to talk about the group. She and six others started the coalition in June of last year. Hargreaves says there have been skeptical and free thought groups in Kansas City for decades, but she wanted something different.
For those who may or may not be familiar with the skeptic or free thought community, it tends to be very male dominated, and the atheist community as well. And that comes very easily apparent as soon as you attend any of these events. There's just more men in the room than women. And I began to ask myself, you know, why is this? You know, what's the reason? I didn't have necessarily an answer for that question, but I thought my, you know, idea was I bet there's a lot more skeptically minded women in the, you know, in Kansas City, and I bet they're just not coming to the events for one or another reason.
It turns out she was right. The Atheist Coalition now has 50 official members, including many women, and two or three times that many non-members have joined in their activities. Part of the group's mission is organizing social events to give members a chance to meet and talk. They hold get-togethers, picnics, and as Sarah explains, they actually have a December holiday party.
The winter holiday is a tradition, is a long-standing tradition. The winter solstice goes back to pagan tradition. So whenever we say holiday party, it's intentionally not specific. It's held in December. We held it in December. I mean, you know, the Christmas holiday is the majority of what Americans kind of acknowledge, but there's also the religious tradition of Hanukkah in the Jewish community. So it's really this winter solstice is a common tradition with a lot of different communities, religious and non-religious. And we're a part of the community, too. We like to have parties. And so we embrace the opportunity to get together and have something where we're, you know, celebrating, you know, friendship and family and togetherness.
The coalition also works to give atheism a positive public face. In places like Westport, they hand out brochures, carry signs, and try to offer an alternative to street corner evangelists. Sarah says they hear a lot of support, but also plenty of hostility to their slogans and signs.
One of the more offensive ones that people caused a reaction out of people was simply a sign that said, "Smile, there is no hell." And even though I think, especially for a free thinker or a skeptic or an atheist, those messages are pretty tame, pretty non-confrontational, just to say something like "there is no hell" really elicits a pretty emotional reaction from a lot of people. And a lot of people just simply said things like, "There is a hell. There is hell. Hell is real." And a lot of people just say things like, "Jesus loves you." And one gentleman, though, drove by and he shouts out his window, "Praise Jesus and F you." A lot of people will cross themselves. Actually, at one event we had, a woman covered her daughter's eyes because apparently she didn't want her daughter to see the word atheist.
The group occasionally sets up a booth called Ask an Atheist on the plaza and local college campuses. And Sarah says the question that's most often asked is something like, "Where do atheists get their morals?" It's something she says she's glad to explain.
For an atheist, this world is all we have. So I think a lot of atheists you'll find are really interested in social justice. And, you know, we kind of have to believe in humanity's ability to fix the world's problems through cooperation, science, and reason, because we're all we have. We can't appeal to any kind of a higher power. We have to appeal to each other and our ability to make things better as good as possible.
Hargreaves says philanthropy is actually one of the major goals of the Kansas City Atheist Coalition. They're a 501c3 nonprofit organization and were founded in part to give people a way to perform charity work without going through a religious organization.
As it is, if you want to do something, you know, if you want to help out at a food pantry, you're going to have to go to your local religious or, you know, church, you know, down the street. That's just kind of how it is right now. So we wanted to do something where people could, you know, have an outlet for their charitable desires through a secular, you know, non-religious organization.
Once a month, coalition members get together to do charity work. They've volunteered for Harvesters and the Humane Society and participated in a blood drive and AIDS walks. But even when doing charity work, they've found being an atheist can still make you unwelcome.
Anytime we go and volunteer anywhere, we make it known that we need to be able to wear our T-shirts because it's obviously we want to, you know, do good for goodness's sake, primarily. But then it's really important to us to be able to do that as out open atheist. And there's been not tons, but there's definitely been some organizations that we've reached out to that didn't, you know, were happy to have us as volunteers. But as soon as the issue of us wearing T-shirts that said the word atheist, you know, it's a deal breaker for some people. They feel like that's, you know, upsetting or controversial or in some way inappropriate.
Back at the Overland Park Sheraton, the afternoon's workshops are over and a handful of convention goers are hanging out in the hotel lobby. In a few minutes, the banquet dinner will start, followed by keynote speaker Nate Phelps. Thinking about the activism work she's done, group member Jennifer explains the approach a lot of atheists now take when talking about their ideas.
I feel like sometimes it's so contentious and it's so wrapped up in so much emotion that it's really difficult for some people to divorce themselves from the emotion of what the issue is and actually talk about it from a rational point of view. So sometimes those discussions, I just basically just kind of end up being like, well, we'll just have to agree to disagree on this one and kind of move on and see where we do agree and what's, you know. So because I would much rather live in a world where we can all get along rather than in a world where we divide ourselves from one another.
For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith. Still to come, suicide rates increase in Kansas. Hear from a therapist helping people cope with depression. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. According to the Kansas Bureau of Vital Statistics, the years of 2006 to 2010 saw a 70% increase in suicides in Johnson County, from 47 to 80. In Kansas, suicides outnumbered homicides by nearly 4-1, and Johnson County was no exception. These local findings track with national trends that find suicide rates down, except for one group, white men ages 40 to 65. What are the factors driving these trends, and how does economic downturn play a role? We asked Rennie Schuler McKinney, a Shawnee Mission Medical Center therapist who's worked with suicidal clients for 25 years.
Through our emergency department at Shawnee Mission Medical Center, we are seeing an increase in the overall attempts within our geographic location here. And particularly the middle-aged white males, we're seeing more attempts, and those individuals are coming through the hospital, and we're trying to reach out to them and help them find some ways to better cope in day-to-day life.
Now, the fact that men have high suicide rates is maps pretty well with the national trends. I mean, nationally, men have more suicides than women that are completed. What, if anything, is different now?
You know, we're still in the middle of this economic crisis. And my belief is that, and what I hear from our patients, those men who have made a serious attempt at their life, they're struggling with that sense of failure. They've been fairly successful in running a household, maintaining a job, providing for their families. And with numerous layoffs throughout the community, men are finding themselves, initially after the layoff, they're energized to go out and find a new job, and they're working maybe off a severance package, and they have some money, or maybe they're tapping into their retirement. But then, as time goes along, and the jobs aren't out there, they're finding themselves in a very huge financial crisis, and for the first time in their life, they're facing a situation where they're no longer feeling that they are the main provider for their family.
Now, you've talked about some of the factors that you've seen in your clinical work. How about these high societal expectations here in Johnson County? Now, we know that not all of Johnson County is affluent, but in terms of the affluent part of Johnson County, how much do those expectations, do you think, play a role in men deciding to commit suicide?
Well, I think in men in general, there's an expectation from our society that they do provide for their families. Here in Johnson County, I think that that may even have some increase in that expectation that they've been able to provide for a very nice home and a nice lifestyle. And when they're not able to provide that anymore and they're having to sell material items just to get by month to month, I think that's playing a larger impact on those individuals.
Something that you often see when someone becomes depressed is also relationship problems. How much do relationship problems that may be triggered by financial stressors play a role in this?
Well, any time a person's faced with a change in lifestyle, be it financial, work obligations, that can impact those individuals around them. And so in this population that we're speaking of, these males, these individuals are not using the same coping skills that they have in the past, and that creates some conflict between them and their spouse. The spouse has an expectation that you get a job, and when they're not able to do so, the conflict continues to increase, and without some kind of an intervention, the male may feel like, I have no other way out.
To what extent do you get phone calls from spouses who are concerned about their husband and don't quite know what to do about it?
In our assessment and intake center here at the hospital, we average over 350 calls every month, and many of those are from loved ones that are concerned, because the person that's experiencing the difficulties often don't know where to reach or are too embarrassed to reach out and ask for help. So often the spouse is the one that's making that initial phone call to say, can you help me? Here are some things I'm seeing. What do you think I might need to do next? And that is such an important step for that family member to take and to reach out so that some type of intervention can start.
Now, suicide in general is linked to undiagnosed mental health disorders in the general population. What are the reasons you hear from men about why they don't reach out and seek help?
So many of them will tell me during sessions, or tell some of the therapists in our treatment program, that they feel like they should be able to handle it themselves. And that old philosophy of pull up by the bootstraps and let's take care of things doesn't always work. So those individuals who don't feel like they can reach out and ask for help, they tend to internalize that. And as things build, they need an outlet. And it sometimes gets to the point where the only outlet that they can see is suicide, is to no longer be present.
You know, generalizations are always dangerous. You know, another generalization you hear is that women tend to have more relationships with girlfriends. They're more connected in the community, whereas men kind of focus on work and don't have a lot of other connections. How much does the lack of social support contribute to maybe the wish to commit suicide and just feeling like there's no place to go?
Well, I agree with your comment that women do tend to share more with their girlfriends or maybe their female coworkers. And what we find is typically men like to share general things such as results of sporting events or what they have plans for the weekend. But to actually say, I'm really struggling and I'm having difficulty sleeping, or gosh, since I've been unemployed, my appetite has changed. I no longer want to go out and fish like I used to. And so as these interests change, they are not sharing with their male friends what's going on. And again, they're holding it inside and not necessarily not being willing to reach out, but at least having a difficult time reaching out because they're not accustomed to doing so like women.
We talked about the men that lose their jobs. In terms of what you're seeing clinically, are you also seeing men who have jobs, but they're more stressed than ever before? Maybe they have more work to do because of downsizing, or the leadership has changed and they have a bad boss. Are you seeing that in terms of it contributing to clinical symptoms?
Yeah, there are numerous factors that are going to contribute, not just the loss of a job, but the loss of a relationship. Men who are struggling with their spouse or their significant other. The expectations in our community is that we do more with less in pretty much every organization. And with those pressures, we're seeing more and more men come in asking for help.
When they ask for help, how do they ask for it? What words do they use to say, I'm in trouble, I need some help?
The unfortunate part is many do not actually say those words. It's as a result of after a suicide attempt that we become involved with them. However, if they actually take that initiative to place the phone call, we can help get them some type of treatment options that can most effectively deal with their depression. And that doesn't always mean inpatient hospitalization. There are so many resources in our community that we can tap into. And what we hear from those same individuals after their treatment, as they move on to a recovery program, is, wow, I had no idea this was available. I feel so much better. Thank you for giving me my life back.
Now, there's a lot of talk about warning signs for suicide. What are some of those warning signs?
Change in appetite or sleep. And for some individuals, that sleep may be I'm sleeping more, I can't get up on the weekends, or it may be I have frequent wakenings in the night and I'm not sleeping well at all. I'm only sleeping 3 or 4 hours a night. It can be a decrease in work performance, not meeting targets or deadlines, increased in risk-taking behaviors. Maybe I speed some and now I'm really a risky driver. I'm irritable. I'm cutting in and out of traffic because I simply am on overload.
If I'm a spouse of someone who starts to show these changes, what do I especially want to look for that are really alarming signs?
Well, I would sure want to pay attention to any type of mannerisms or change in behavior. I think one of the biggest myths is that we don't want to ask direct questions for fear that might give the individual an idea. I want to discount that wholeheartedly and say it's most important to be very direct and to say, John, I have noticed some changes and I'd like to talk to you about this. And then be very specific on what those questions are.
Should you ask the person, are you thinking about harming yourself?
Absolutely. There may be comments that, oh, you guys would be better off without me. There's days where I just can't take it anymore. When you hear those, and you don't even have to wait to hear something that specific, you want to say, I have enough concern and love for you that I want to ask you a very difficult question. But I need to know, are you having thoughts about taking your life or harming yourself in any way? If that person is resistant initially, revisit it. Come back to the conversation later in the afternoon or the next day. And to know the resources and to reach out and tap into those resources is vital.
So what's the road back? How do you help people in treatment go from feeling suicidal and depressed back to themselves again?
One of the most important things is follow through. Some individuals will, post-suicide attempt, will seek inpatient hospitalization where they're actually in a treatment program. Others will join outpatient therapy where you're going in to see a therapist maybe once a week. There's also a step up from that where you're going multiple times a week.
Specifically, do you work on people's attitudes? How do you actually, what do you work on to help them make the changes that they need to make?
We take two different approaches. Of course, with depression, many are able to be treated with medications, and so we're doing an assessment to determine if that's appropriate. There are some individuals who say, I just want to do this on my own. And so through talk therapy, we're addressing the skills that may be there but we haven't utilized, being more assertive, being more direct, dealing with the understanding that by developing these skills, I can better handle the stress and those situations that are occurring day in and day out so that I'm more equipped to be able to address them as they arise.
Rennie Schuler-McKinney is a therapist at Shawnee Mission Medical Center's Behavioral Health Program.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
The Belger Arts Center often displays work from its own extensive collection, sometimes adding pieces borrowed from other collectors. A current exhibition, a tribute to ceramic artist Don Wrights, includes nearly 100 bowls, vessels, and jars, many from Wrights' own collection, and a few platters reveal a turning point in the artist's career, as KCUR Laura Spencer reports.
On the ground floor at the Belger Arts Center, tall ceramic totems with colorful drawings carved into the surface are lit like Japanese lanterns. Walk up the stairs or take the lift to the third floor, and there are early works from Don Reitz's student days, like a 1960s blue and green striped earthy punch bowl set, and a series from the 1980s, three large platters side by side. Gallery associate Mo Dickens.
We've done a lot of shows here, and I've seen an inscription from time to time, but I've never seen pieces inscribed like these are. So we have to walk around to the back of the platters to see what Don, what messages he sent to his sister and his niece. Can we go back there?
Look closely on the back of one platter, and there's a heart almost hidden behind a piece of metal propping it up. Mo Dickens reads some of the words.
Tomorrow this will just be an echo down a rusty railroad track. Hold tight, I'm coming, Uncle Don. Really dealt a bad hand.
So my narrative drawings are started before Sarah, but the Sarah series is very important. It was a healing series and a spiritual series.
In 1982, Don Reitz was in a truck accident, and he was told he wouldn't walk again. And while he was in the hospital, he learned his father had died.
And so I began revisiting my childhood in the hospital, making sketches. When I got better, I started drawing about my childhood, about showing off to Claire Matthews, riding my bicycle upside down.
His young niece Sarah sent him get-well cards with pictures, and then he learned she had cancer. He incorporated some of her images, tracing them into large platters of clay. There were messages of encouragement on the back.
Sarah one time said to me when she was getting better, then she said, Uncle Don, if you're such a great artist, how come you need my drawings a copy? I thought, wow. So I said, well, thank you, Sarah. She was saying, I am better. You're better. Let's both get on with our lives.
His niece Sarah is now in her 30s with three young kids, and Reitz has been a full-time studio artist since the mid-1980s, living on a ranch in Arizona and giving workshop demonstrations around the country.
My philosophy is the only constant we have in life is change. Without change, nothing happens. You can't be afraid to change, you see. Don't try to walk in somebody else's shoes. You're walking in your own shoes, and you have to discover who you are. So art for me is a discovery process. It's always been a discovery process about who I really am, you know, what I really believe in.
Wright says he still likes to work large, like his totems, crafted from huge clay pipes that return to storytelling and childlike imagery. But these days, he'll turn 83 in November. He gets a little help from studio assistants.
Your work changes because of your physical ability not to do something, but the attitude does not change. The reason for working does not change. You do not change in your heart and your mind.
Reitz plans to return to Kansas City to try something new, creating a print with Lawrence Lithography Workshop. Again, Belger Arts Center Gallery Associate Mo Dickens.
Don follows his own passion. He once said that he's never done anything and worried about whether it was going to sell or whether anybody would like it. He just makes what he wants to make. When I went to his studio last year, he came out to the driveway and said, "Welcome to my sandbox." He's still playing.
Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
The exhibition Don Reitz at the Belger Center continues through November 3rd. For more information and photos, check out the Arts and Culture page of our website at kcur.org.
Coming up, a political rock musical that highlights the life of America's 7th president. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, Sprint Nextel was talking with a prospective buyer. The KU Hospital pioneered a new use for GPS technology, and Kansas Governor Sam Brownback had second thoughts about letting a sales tax increase expire. Steve Bell revisits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
Governor Sam Brownback continued to hard sell his income tax reduction plan the legislature okayed, but he did say he might want to extend Kansas' temporary sales tax increase if total revenues decline too steeply in the first year of his tax cuts.
Let's see where we are budgetarily before there be any discussion of that.
Brownback also continued to insist that a task force on education was not put in place to cut spending for public schools. As the panel met for its first time, its chairman Ken Willard of the State Board of Education said it was about efficiency.
To get a better bang for our buck, better use of our dollars for the most effective education possible for Kansas school children.
Brownback's task force has been heavily criticized by educators because it includes no school administrators and no teachers. Sprint Nextel executives confirmed to the Wall Street Journal that they're discussing selling a controlling interest to Japanese wireless carrier SoftBank. Analysts said it would be good for Sprint and its presence in the Kansas City area, SoftBank called it speculation. The KU Hospital announced that it was the first in the nation to use a new cardiac catheter guidance system that dramatically reduces patient radiation exposure. Dr. John Day is editor-in-chief of a national cardiology journal.
We'll see in the range of 30 to 50 minutes of X-ray time. The Leipzig group reported that they were able to keep their X-ray imaging time to less than 2 minutes.
The new catheter guidance system uses technology similar to GPS. The Kansas City Chiefs front office fought off a controversy, said most Chiefs fans are not like the ones that cheered last Sunday when quarterback Matt Cassel was knocked unconscious on the field. Coach Romeo Crennel told reporters Monday that Cassel was sidelined with a concussion.
With the emphasis on concussions in the league, they're making sure that we do due diligence in making sure that he's not rushed back.
Brady Quinn was designated fill-in quarterback for the Tampa Bay game. An audit showed that Kansas City ambulances are a minute slower getting to patients since a system change last December. Public Safety Chair John Sharp called that unacceptable.
This has certainly, been disastrous as far as impacting response times.
But the city manager and acting fire chief said that minute was consumed by a protocol endorsed by national firefighting organizations in which dispatchers ask callers more questions. Senator Claire McCaskill released new campaign ads featuring victims of rape and incest, criticizing Todd Akin's comments on rape and pregnancy.
As a woman of faith, I must forgive Todd Akin. But as a voter, it's not something I can forget.
The latest Akin ads called McCaskill corrupt.
The moment her hand came off the Bible, it went into our pockets.
Several hundred businesses McCaskill's husband has interests in received federal subsidies totaling about $40 million, but Associated Press said McCaskill actually voted against some of the bills containing them. This is KCUR.
It's like the Discovery Channel with booze, where whiskey meets wisdom. Area nerds unite once a month in Kansas City for Nerd Nights. And in the spirit of Halloween, we hear a talk about the vampire boyfriend characters that suck blood and drain souls of their partners. KCR's Suzanne Hogan was there.
Every third Wednesday of the month, a bunch of local nerds meet up at Mini Bar to listen to presentations about various nerdy topics, from raising silkworms to the healing powers of Jin Shinjitsu. Jason Kovac and Allison Hurrier started the Kansas City chapter, but they happen all around the world, as far away as Liberia and as close as Lawrence. They originated in the Boston area in 2003. We're about to hear from Kansas City's fourth Nerd Night, which was last July. Co-founder Jason Kovac gets the night started.
Good evening, and welcome to Nerd Night Kansas City, where we celebrate the fact that it is cool to know stuff. And in Kansas City, we know a lot of cool people who know a lot of cool stuff. Before we get started, as we do every Nerd Night, by way of invocation, we celebrate a patron nerd to help us get the evening started right. This evening's patron nerd is James Harrison, who in 1851 invented the modern-day ice-making machine, without which we wouldn't have air conditioning ice for your drinks or cool beers. Help me get this started right. A toast to James Harrison and his ice. Thank you. Cheers.
Now we're going to hear from a talk given that night by presenter Melissa Lanos. Melissa has spent a lot of time researching vampire boyfriends. She's an assistant professor at Donnelly College, and her primary research areas are narratology and Hollywood, with a focus on film remakes. Here she is.
So by day, I'm pretty much your garden variety English professor. But by night, I am a narratologist. And that means that I study stories. I'm interested in the stories that we tell across cultures and what they mean and also what their function is, meaning what they do for us. Because what you'll find is if we have stories that turn up over and over again, for us in our popular culture, that's not accidental. These stories recur because they have meaning for us and because they do something for us. So I am particularly interested in stories that repeat, but also in this idea of archetypes and tropes. So characters, story themes. Think about the idea of the girl next door, right? We talk about that as a character type, which is another way of saying trope, meaning, again, that this is a symbol that we use over and over again because it means something to us. And what does it do? What does it fulfill for us as a culture that we keep using it over and over again? So if you think about an archetype or a trope like the vampire that goes in sort of cycles, that it turns up for a period of time and then it dies out and then it comes back again, that there's a reason for that cycle. And what I'm particularly interested in is where that trope changes. How do we change the vampire so that it serves a kind of function for us culturally? And what does that mean? So there's this great scholar named Nina Auerbach who said once that every generation gets the vampires it deserves. And I love this idea because this is a character type that changes pretty regularly. And the people who have been studying the vampire so far go back to the 18th century. The studies pretty much go to the 1990s because that's when the last great vampire craze died down before our current one. Stoker's Dracula is the first big shift, right? Because he is the sexually threatening vampire. Dracula is basically about a fear of disease and about sexualized violence. And this is when we get the beginning of film also. So early cinema's vampires were pretty much variations on Dracula. They're kind of appealing, they're kind of intriguing, but they're also kind of gross and scary, and we don't want to get too close to them. Anne Rice and another author named Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, they sort of move, they transition the vampire into a sexy kind of broody hero. But they're still mostly interested in other vampires. If you think back to Interview with a Vampire, those vampires pretty much just stay together. If they're interested in humans, they either turn them right away or they just have them for lunch and then move on. They're mostly concerned with their community of vampires, so they kind of stay to themselves. It's in the late 20th century that vampires become really interested in humans, to the extent that they start interacting in human communities and venturing into romances with humans. And then we get the big turnaround, and some of you know what this is. Buffy. I'll just pause and say that I'm not a Buffy scholar. That's like a thing now, to be a Buffy scholar. That's not what I am. And she's a really, really important reference point, but it's a little bit too involved to get too far into. I'm talking to you guys about vampires. You run into a vampire, what does he want from you? He wants your blood, right? But there's another kind of vampire that we sometimes refer to called a psychic vampire. And a psychic vampire is a figure who draws your life energy. And some of you may have dated people like that. So people who are not sucking out your blood, but they are kind of sucking your life energy and sucking your kind of will to move forward. So psychic vampires are different from sanguinary vampires, sanguine meaning blood. So those are two kind of different things that I'd like you to keep in the back of your head, because I'm going to come back to those. So once we hit this Buffy marker in the late 1990s, we have more and more contemporary vampires who are interested in humans, and not just interacting with them, but forming relationships with them. So our logical next step is the vampire boyfriend. So this is Angel, who Buffy meets in 1997. And he's a prototype. And when you get to Edward Cullen of the Twilight series, you can even see some resemblance there. It's sort of an inevitable endpoint with Edward Cullen. He's a vampire who is so obsessed with humans, and he's so fixated on humans, that he's no longer threatening. He's barely a vampire at this point. So To jump a little bit back to the scholarship, there's been a lot written about vampires as metaphors for physical and emotional domestic violence, and also addiction, right? That, like, bloodlust is a literal, like, a very literal euphemism for the state of addiction. And these metaphors are all over the place with these texts. If you've seen any of them, they're foregrounded really heavily. But there's something else going on, and it's that bleeding of the line between the idea of the sanguine vampire, the vampire who sucks your blood, and the emotional, the psychic vampire who sucks your life energy. And that line is really heavily blurred in a lot of these texts. And that's what I'm really kind of interested in, is the idea that what we're going to learn about from this character archetype and its shifts from the 18th century to the contemporary time is what that means, to blur the lines between a vampire who sucks your blood and a vampire who just is, like, exhausting and needy and an emotionally dysfunctional boyfriend. So, because there are only a couple of options if you've got a text with a vampire boyfriend. You can emphasize the remaining humanity in the vampire character, and then you get Edward Cullen, right? How many of you have seen Twilight? Is that, you're lying, so many of you have seen Twilight. Edward Cullen is super boring as a vampire. He doesn't kill people. He doesn't drink people's blood. So that is one possible extreme. Or, on the other side, you can emphasize the surrounding human's monstrosity, right? That you have violence and the death drive and this fascination with all of the different kinds of penetration that you get with a vampire boyfriend. And that's where, you know, why we become interested in vampires as a culture to begin with. And something like Let the Right One In is the other end point of that. But my point for today is that we've moved into this interest of the vampire as a kind of detached alien figure who is ultimately threatening, but who is also an ultimately doomed potential romantic interest. Because if you have a vampire boyfriend, there are a couple options for those of you with vampire boyfriends. He can turn you, like with Twilight, he turns you into a vampire. Your relationship fails, spoiler alert, or your vampire boyfriend can accidentally kill you, as Mitchell in Being Human does many, many times throughout the course of that series. So there are not a lot of options for what can happen. So between the impossibility of the relationship and the repeated themes of the psychic vampirism, these boyfriends are so excruciatingly needy. They're so incapable of functioning without a girlfriend's constant intervention and the eventual literal and figurative draining of that girlfriend, that there's this kind of pessimism in the face of contemporary heterosexual relationships that I'm reading here over and over again. That these texts are kind of about the work of what it means to have a relationship, but that that work doesn't work, right? That it just is doomed to failure one way or another. So tracking this trope and how it's been developed will give a sense of how we as a culture negotiate the idea of heteronormativity and the idea of how relationships work. And that's kind of where I'm going. The longer version of this project maps how the trope shifts across international lines, and particularly with a text that's called My Boyfriend is a Vampire, which is where I got the name for the project. It's a Korean comic book, and the teenage boy is bitten by a vampire, and he turns into a vampire, but also he becomes a human who can spontaneously shift from male to female at will. So it creates a really kind of complicated idea of the sanguine vampire, but also the psychic vampire. But then it adds this kind of interesting shift where we're moving away from heteronormativity and we're looking at how these themes might be applicable in more kinds of alternative texts. So that's, like, the next part. I'm waiting for the translation. So that's where I'm going with this.
Melissa Lanos teaches English at Donnelly College. She spoke at Nerd Night Kansas City last July. Nerd Night is the third Wednesday of every month at Minibar. You can go to our website at kcur.org, type in Nerd Night for more information. For KCUR, I'm Suzanne Hogan. We'll be right back.
If there's not enough political theater in the run-up to the November elections, the Unicorn Theater is offering a bit more with its production of Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, the emo rock musical of America's 7th president. Now that it's popping up at regional theaters across the country, the composer and show's lead actor and director all hint that the current political climate makes it more relevant than ever. KCUR's Steve Walker reports.
Upon entering the Unicorn Theater at a recent rehearsal of its 2012 season opener, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, one is taken aback by the enormity of the set. A 55-foot-wide melange of red draping and fabric is festooned with items like cartoonishly enlarged currency, Native American artifacts, and animal skulls. At stage right sits the facade of a log cabin, while stage left is the familiar portico of the White House, representing the arc of Jackson's life. Playing the president is Shay Kaufman, who is running through a number about a decision on Indian affairs called The Saddest Song.
When it stops being fun and your patience is done and you see being president's hard, this country before you that cannot be governed, you find yourself powerless, bloody, and scorned. You want to implore the love of the people. Who is it for? This nation we made. That guy put in everything his way. Where has he gone?
The show's composer, Michael Friedman, says the idea for musicalizing Jackson's life arose within the first hour of a professional blind date with theater artist Alex Timbers, who wrote the book and directed the New York production.
Alex's theater company, Les Frères Corbusier, was really interested actually in history, American history, comic ways of approaching history, and specifically presidents. And I actually, in college, was a history and literature major, and I took an entire course in Jacksonian America. First of all, we were really interested in the contemporary resonances, and it felt like having a very contemporary score was important. The more we looked at Jackson, the more it did seem like he was kind of a historical rock star. For me, the funniest part is the sort of emo punk idea.
Friedman adds that they began writing it during George W. Bush's presidency, but as the project developed, their Andrew Jackson began to morph into someone more complex.
What's funny is once you start doing that, we began to realize that, of course, Jackson's a whole lot like Reagan. He's obviously hugely like Bill Clinton with his kind of, I feel your pain. And then as time moved forward, he seemed a whole lot like Barack Obama, like the Tea Party, like Sarah Palin. So if strangely, as history moved forward, parallels and resonances that we'd written to mean one thing turned out to resonate with a completely different event in history.
Directing the Unicorn production is Cynthia Levin, who says she was compelled by the show's irreverence and how staging it this fall heightens its timeliness.
I wanted to do it this fall. I wanted to do it before November 6th. It was very important to me. Everyone's head is in this race right now. Everybody's thinking about it. And so here we are doing a play about a man running for president and a man running for president who won the popular vote, yet they said, well, you didn't get the electoral vote, so we're going to pick our own president, and lost the first time he ran. So all these really great things that have happened in the last 10 years, our lifetime, that certainly were also happening then.
Playing a president as fond of tight pants as he is himself is Shay Kaufman, who says he agrees with Michael Friedman's assessment that Jackson invented how the current campaign for president looks.
Do you want a man who will run for office that is going to change who they are or make themselves for you to believe that they are something else? Or do you want someone who will stick to what they are and maybe just doesn't have the drive to keep going? There's a line towards the end of the show. He's talking to one of the Indians and he says, this is the least bad solution. What I'm offering you right now is the least bad solution.
It wouldn't be off base to say that the Unicorn is shrewdly marketing the show to rock fans, history buffs, and political junkies alike. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson runs through November 4th at the Unicorn Theater. For more information, visit the arts and culture section of our website at kcur.org.
As always, we want to thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern. And our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.